light. How do you make the light go? Let's get going. So hopefully that you've seen already, if you're in the, you know, Monday labs, that we went over stuff. That's already all posted. Echo lectures, the first part, and then when we did the review, that's posted. Podcast lecture, the first class, the battery died a little bit halfway through, but it's the same as the second section. So all these are basically the same, except for the review sections when people ask different questions and we went over it. Probably really easy just to look at, you know, like section 3. It's all the same, basically, with all three lectures, and Wednesday will be the same, too. If you didn't come to the earlier ones, anybody going to NCUR, you have all this you can download. And then today, we'll put this up right after class, today's stuff. And then we have, what do we have tomorrow? A wonderful day. And it should go relatively quick. I haven't made the exam yet. You know, something to do tonight, no spare time. But most of it's going to be multiple choice, right? And definitely look through all your answers. Don't just jump to an answer. And then, you know, do a process of elimination to get off the answers that are crazy. If you have to guess, at least you can get it down to two. But some of the answers are just, you know, like a few. To get A, B, C, D, E, sometimes you have to put some weirdly weird, you know, responses in there, and you'll know that those don't make any sense at all, right? So cross out those and maybe get your guessing if you have to down to two. But I'm not trying to make difficult questions, right? I'm trying to make them general, straight. You might think it's difficult, but they're not meant to be, and they're not meant to be tricky. So straightforward. Now, on that quiz that we had with Endocrine, I was hoping that was kind of like get you going. All those questions came out of old exams. You know, I'm lazy. I just kind of picked them off all old exams. So every one of those questions was out of an old exam. And so I'll probably do the same thing at midnight, you know, tonight or something, to try and make an exam tomorrow with a lot of them. But the problem is you memorize a question and an answer, but the question, if you've looked at the old exams, you know, you change it around a little bit, right? And it's, you know, it's kind of like the first test when we said, how does the cell condition itself for cold, right? And you talk about the bilipid membrane and all that, but then you change around, how does it condition it to warm, right? And then everything kind of changes. So when you're looking at the old exams, I keep saying this, read the question, hide the answers, try to answer the question on your own first, then look through the answers and figure out which one it might be. So it's really good not to just try to have recognition, but actually understand the question. I'll try to put more questions on there than just 100%, like 104 or 106%, so that gives you your bonus, or that gives you your curve, basically. So you've got to earn that curve. And hopefully that will help people. Remember the first exam, the average was an 82, so it's pretty good. But I know the quizzes are, you know, some of the quizzes dropped you down. Now, on the quizzes, we had 60%, 60 points for participation in this lecture part. You know, those are quizzes. But what we'll do is add another one of these class participation things, you know, like what we did with scratch-offs or quizzes. So there'll be, and we'll drop the lowest one, okay? So we'll go through and make sure that if you didn't have sevens or you missed a day and you didn't realize it was posted on the web page that we have a quiz that day, and you just didn't come, and so you can drop the lowest one. So we'll go through and drop the lowest quiz. Does that help? Decrease the stress, and where I mention that now, so you can kind of decrease stress for studying a little bit. So some people over the years, you know, with a multiple choice test like this in an hour and in 15 minutes, you'll probably finish, some people will finish in 35 minutes, and they'll make an A on it. And some people will finish in 35 minutes and you're poorly. But the point is I'm making is that usually if you know your stuff and you study and you're not sleep deprived, like if you stay up all night long, you're so delirious you can't read the questions, right? And you don't think right. And Adderall is not going to help you. Okay. It does not really work well. So don't do that. Okay. You know, just think about the question. Don't get all worked up. Just think, read the question well. There's a lot of anxiety, you know, during tests. But just relax. Read the question. Okay. And you'll do fine. So I'll make that test tonight. And it's not meant to be crazy. It's meant to be straightforward. There will be some questions of open response, very short answers, because we don't have a lot of time to answer those. So it's not meant for a paragraph. It's meant to be a short answer, right? Or maybe some description or line diagrams or something. We'll work through it. Now, on the other aspect, I know you will study more material than we can possibly ask on this kind of test. So you're going to be like some of the people who say, gosh, I studied all that and there was no question on it. That's just the way it is, because we can't put every question. So I'm going to try to balance it out with, you know, questions from everything that we covered, right? And as we went through in the labs, in tomorrow's lab, we're going to try to hit all the different chapters. So what did we cover again? Behavior, sensory, skeletal muscle, endocrine, cardiovascular. Did we leave off something? And today's stuff, right? And so, you know, you pull up all those PowerPoints, like we said in the labs, go through them, kind of look through it, say, what did we emphasize? Because remember, just like the last quizzes, I just emphasized what we covered in class. You know, I didn't go off and say, you got to read chapter 3, because I don't care about which textbook you get. It's kind of the content, right? And no matter what textbook you get in, like, comparative phys, it's pretty much all the same material. So it's the stuff that we're emphasizing in class, or integrating, right? And I know that takes time to integrate. So let's go through some of that integration today, and hopefully that'll help. Any burning questions? Remember old exams? We tried to answer that in the lab sections Wednesday's class. We're going to do the same thing. See you tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And, you know, we'll go through it and then have a chance to answer any questions. Now, I will try to answer questions up to like 11 or 12 at night to give you the, you know, chance to, you know, if you're stressed out. I know some people have lots of other exams in other classes. Some people have 3 exams this week. You know, it's just, it's the timing. All the faculty get together and like to torture people and have exams on the same, no, I'm joking. You know, I know that you get a lot of exams at the same time. It's just the way it kind of works. But I'll try to answer questions up to midnight on Wednesday night, okay?
What are the lab times for tomorrow?
Tomorrow's lab time is the same as, you know, a normal. It's, what is it, 9 to 12, right?
Okay. Is it just the one, or is there like a 12 to 3?
No, it's just the morning, because then the other class has the other sections, and they didn't even have a review as far as I know, and they don't even record Echo 360, and they don't even record podcasts, and they didn't give a test bank to those kids either, so...
But you're wonderful.
I know, thank you. Just remember that during evaluations. But I do torture you with a lot of information, right? I do try to give you a lot, and... I know it's some of times it might be overburdened, but I want to put everything out there for you to use and that you're not limited. Because I know that sometimes there's old exams in fraternities and sororities, so this is why I just put out the whole test bank to give everybody the same equal chance, right? That it's not like there was an extra exam somewhere else. So everybody should have the same information in here. Some of the students in the other sections of the other 350 class that's going on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they've actually asked for the test bank. They've asked others, and you can give it to them. It doesn't matter, because that's, you know, it's out there for all of you to use. They're actually using some of our Echo recordings for their class, so it's kind of interesting. Okay, so I did want to point out that all that's posted up here under the different sections, section 1, 2, 3, and 4, and tomorrow's will be posted right away, and then today's stuff is posted right there at the PowerPoint. All right, is that a question or no? Did she have your hand? Did you have your hand up?
Oh.
No. Okay. I wasn't sure what's going on. Okay. So let's go through some of this material. And, you know, sorry, I was just joking with that first part because you don't have enough to study. But anyways, I know you do. All right. Okay. Better get that out of there before you start throwing things at me. So in Wednesday's class, we'll talk more about that too. But you've had the EKG information. And what is a STEMI? Just to give you some information on this, it's kind of fun. So you can go to these links, and you know about the EKG, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit too. But this ST segment, remember these segments that we've talked about before? or that you covered in your class, in your lab section. It's kind of interesting that these EKGs are so valuable to understand what's going on your heart. And we'll look at some other aspects too, but there's some really interesting aspects. If this changes its shape, it's an indication that something's gone amok. And so sometimes, not all the times, but they call it a raised ST. Anybody do cardio work as a tech or anything like that? No? There's great jobs out there that you can actually become a technician to read EKGs, and it's not that hard to get the certification. You know, you can do it over the summer and get a certificate in reading EKGs, and you'll work in a hospital and read those monitors that are going on all the time. And it's an important job because, you know, you're on the ICU floor or on the floor and you're actually reading these, and because everybody's always hearing beep, beep, beep when it goes off or a lead comes off somebody and nobody pays attention to it, but you're actually hired to pay attention to that. And it's really important because then it can change really quick. If somebody had an operation, for example, or neurosurgery, and you know they're leaking something, cerebral spinal fluid, or have an internal aneurysm or something crazy, or their ion balance comes off, you can actually pick up a lot on the EKG. For example, if this rises, like what they call a raised ST segment, it's a good indication that you had a myocardial infarction. Not all the time, but it's a case. Sometimes these dip down, and they call it a Dali mustache, because it looks like Salvador Dali's mustache. And it actually indicates that maybe you're on digoxin, which is normal. It's not a toxicity, but it happens normally. And so that's kind of interesting. And then sometimes these T waves spike. They get really big. And that's an indication of, and it depends on the lead you're looking at, that's an indication of hyperkalemia, hyperpotassium, high potassium. So just by an EKG reading, you can tell a lot about ionic balance. You can tell about some actions of the heart, even traumatic brain injury. Sometimes they can see changes in the T shape as well. And so it's really quite interesting that you can tell so much about the body, ion control as well, because what makes up this electrical signal? Movement of ions, right? And how the heart is functioning. So there's a lot about the EKG. So just to kind of show you a little bit, that's kind of fun too. So I don't want you to have to memorize these different things. I just want you to realize that you can get a lot from it. And I know you're just worried about what's on the exam. But, you know, here, look at these kind of raised values. Maybe I can make this bigger somehow. These raised values. And it depends on the lead that you're recording. I don't want you to have to memorize these different leads. But, you know, like there's a 12 EKG lead in the normal 1, 2, 3 leads. But let's go down to something here. I think there's some interesting ones. So here's like a ST with a traumatic brain injury. It doesn't look normal, right? These are raised. It's kind of interesting. So you can tell a lot what's going on. So you can look at these. These are kind of a link on the line. Maybe you don't have time right now with the test, but you know, over the summer it's kind of fun to look at. This is a depressed one. You can look at the rates of these. So people actually measure how the slope is and how they look on different leads, and it tells you a good indication. It's not the final thing, but it gives you a window into what might be going wrong. Oh, here's the Dali one. This is kind of cool. See how this one is, the QRS, and you see that little twitch right here, this little mustache. And what's this one of again? This is, yeah, the digoxin treatment. So it just causes this kind of altered EKG lead. And so it's not abnormal. It means that somebody's on this treatment. And we can talk a little bit about that. Yes, it's a medication. It's given to people for cardiac problems. And that's a really good question, too. So let's just think about how does this work. And what this does is actually, this drug, for example, is this thing working? If you draw a cardiac cell, let me focus this thing. Okay. If you draw a cardiac cell, how does digoxin work, for example? And it's interesting. So what do we have in these cells? We have you got sodium, you got potassium, you got calcium, but there's a sodium-potassium pump, ATP-dependent pump. And which way do the ions go on this again? Some of these basic things we really forget.
Sodium to potassium.
sodium on the pump. With sodium's leaking in, so you want to pump it out, right? So sodium gets pumped out and potassium gets pumped back in, right? Sodium potassium pump. And usually it's like 3-2, right? Generally, but you know, there's some exceptions to it. So digoxin, this drug that's here, is really quite interesting because it's more selective to the sodium potassium pump in your heart. So you have sodium potassium pumps in your nervous system and all your other cells, right, to maintain ion balance, but there's different isoforms. This one happens to work really well. This isoform and this drug works well for the cardiac digoxin. So what happens if we were to block this, for example, you know, with this drug? Well, you got to be careful, right? But what would happen to sodium then? Sodium would build up, right, inside the cell. But is that good? Is that bad? You know, why would they want to do that? Why would you want to give somebody a drug that blocks the sodium potassium pump in your heart? Isn't that bizarre? You would think, oh my God, that's horrible, right? You know, if you did that in the nervous system, what's going to happen in the nervous system? Sodium's going to build up in there, and that might cause voltage-gated sodium channels to inactivate, right? If you depolarize it slowly, we've talked about that. But in the heart, there's something really interesting, because where does calcium come from in the heart? Calcium, kind of review, outside, extracellular food, as well as the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And we know that calcium is very important in the heart for doing what? Contraction, right? Remember the long action potential in the ventricular muscle to have a long contraction, right? Like 200 to 300 milliseconds in duration. So we want calcium in there. And we want calcium to maybe stay a little longer to help maybe make a strong contraction. Well, how does calcium get out of the cell? Once it comes in through, remember, so calcium's going to come in through voltage-gated calcium channels. It's also going to come in there and leak out from the SER, right? Calcium, right? How does calcium get out of the cell? A pump. So there's actually a pump, ATP-dependent pump. It's called the plasma membrane PMC, and it actually pumps calcium out, so that's a pump. It requires ATP. Is there another process? There are some calcium-binding proteins, and of course it binds to troponin, C, right, for calcium. So there might be some calcium binding proteins, but for a lot of the regulation, and we talked a little bit about it at the nerve terminal also, how else does calcium get out?
The circa.
Well, that's very important too, because that's going to pump calcium back up into the ER. So we have the, I'll write it here, SERA, like the circa pump. Sorry, can you see that mess? So there's a pump here in the ER. It's ATP dependent also. So wow, a lot of ATP needed, right? One other key factor we're thinking about, which is really key to this whole process. Mitochondria does take up some calcium, very good. So we're remembering all this from the nervous system. Mitochondria's going to do it. But another factor where this is really important. There's another not the sodium potassium. Sodium calcium exchanger. Exchangers do not require ATP. So they're not a pump. It's an exchanger. So here we have an exchanger, non-ATP, and it depends which way it's going. But sodium's usually high on the outside of the cell, right? Very high. And so is calcium. But sodium's, you know, quite high. And in the nerve terminal, we've mentioned that if calcium's coming in the nerve terminal, it needs to get out quickly so you can have another action potential and cause more vesicles to fuse, so you don't just keep having vesicles, right? So calcium's sucked up in the mitochondria, it's bound to calcium-binding proteins, it's pumped out of the cell, but also the sodium-calcium exchanger is doing what? Calcium out and sodium's in. Sodium's always high on the outside, so as soon as calcium comes in, because it's so low, what's going to happen? That's going to be a big driving gradient. The sodium's so high outside, it wants to get calcium out as soon as it comes in. So what just happened here? Calcium's just dropped in because of this contraction, right? The action potential stimulated the cell. Calcium's dumping in. So what happened? Calcium just all of a sudden rose, and now we need to get it out because sodium is already high, you know, on the outside, right? About 120 millimolar or so. Depends on the animal and which cell we're talking about. But it's really high on the outside. So as soon as calcium's in there, boy, it wants to pump it out. But what happens if we block the pump with this digoxin? Dig, they call it sometimes. If we block the pump or reduce its function, not completely block it, that would be dangerous, but reduce the function, block some of them, what's going to happen to the sodium level inside now? It's going to start to rise, right? And if this starts to rise, what happens to the driving gradient right here?
Decreases.
So what happens to the calcium coming out? Decreases. So what happens to the calcium inside? Builds up. What happens to muscle contraction then? Get it? Isn't that cool? By working on the pump, you've increased the sodium-potassium pump, you've increased calcium inside the cell, and you've increased the contractility of the heart. So somebody that's having a weak heart that's not working well, by giving the DIG, you get a stronger contraction. That's pretty neat, isn't it? So this is exactly, you know, where we're going.
So digoxin is like pretty toxic too.
Oh yes.
Yes, but why does it cause fibrosis of the lungs?
Other aspects. There's a lot of side effects with digoxin, and actually if somebody's on it, they need to get a blood test every once in a while to look at their level. So if you're ever working as a phlebotomist or something like that, you might see that there's a digoxin run, and it's basically to test them. And they can get into a toxicity level, so there's a very narrow window of therapeutic index for the drug. And there's a lot of deaths that can occur from this. Right? I think if your kidneys aren't working well, usually people have multiple problems, right? If your kidneys aren't working well and excretion's not well, then they can get into this high level and have a toxicity effect. It actually affects the vision as well, lots of things. But, you know, the primary aspect is that this sodium-potassium pump has a little different isoform, which is similar but not the same in the structure, and this drug works more selectively on the cardiac sodium-potassium pump than it does on other cells, but at a certain level, it's going to start hitting those too.
If you have a mechanism that will increase the contractility, does that also correlate to, like, will the rate, will that do anything to the rate?
Oh, so the question was, will it do anything to the rate? If you had a, it could, right? But you're trying to, the pacemaker is more or less the rate, right?
Right? It's more about strength.
Yeah, it's the strength. And remember, the sympathetic system is both rate and contractility. So remember what we've talked about with sympathetic? What is it? The two terms that we should remember? It is chronotropic with rate and inotropic for strength of contraction, right? And so this is an inotropic drug, primarily an inotropic drug. And you might hear people on this, and this is it, and they might say, I need to go get my blood checked. I'm having, you know, vision problems. I'm feeling dizzy. I'm nauseous. And it could be the side effects of this. And you can look up this drug and look at it, and it's, you know, it's life-saving in some cases, but it can be very dangerous, like many medications and the other aspects. So we got off on a little bit of a tangent, but you see that you can usually tell it very quickly on the EKG. And so that's kind of interesting. Really neat things with the EKG. It's just phenomenal what you can tell with the body. And then, so you can kind of go through those on your own time. I'm not going to test you on these different all these different aspects. I just want you to realize that there's a lot to the EKG, and I think we... You know, you don't put enough time into really doing this. You could have a whole course just on cardiovascular system, right? Other aspects that are really cool.
Mm-hmm. I got a question. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to clarify, when we block that sodium potassium pump and then sodium increases, is the calcium coming from the SR?
Yeah, the calcium is still coming from the normal depolarization, SR, you know, all that other stuff that we've talked about, like calcium leak from the ranitidine a little bit. And remember, that activates, and the sodium comes in, and then that depolarizes the voltage-gated calcium channels, then calcium works on the circa, calcium-induced calcium release, and that rises. So all that's going in on top of all of this. So it's quite complicated.
Well, after, like, if it's too high, that's when the circa, that's when it stops.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So, like, where's the increase?
Oh, well, primarily, I mean, you're still stimulating the cell. You're still stimulating the heart electrically. So you're getting calcium through voltage-gated calcium channels, and you're getting it dumped out from the SR with that whole feedback that we talked about before with the ranitidine receptor, right? Yeah. But if it goes too high, like you said, then it's going to block the ranitidine, and you're not going to get that calcium. So you see where the toxicity, that fine level of playing around in the cell, could really muck things up. Very sensitive, right? So there's a, what people have found is there's a very narrow window for this drug without the side effect. Okay. Now, you could stimulate the sympathetic system, just keep giving people exams every day, right? And keep the heart rate up. No, I'm joking. Okay. Sadistic, I know. Okay. So let's look at some other aspects. Did you all do this? We used to do this in 350, and it's really fun to do. The EKG on lead 1, lead 2, lead 3? No? I mean, you took leads,
we
right?
We had three leads, yeah. But we didn't learn about them.
You didn't do that mean electrical axis? Or just for fun? Did you ever do this in like high school or something? We take the little leads out and go to schools and have fun, but we have to ask volunteers and make sure parents are okay and all that good stuff. Usually we take some volunteers, usually it's the teacher, and, you know, kind of fun, but then you record heart rates and things. But this is kind of neat, too, because if you look at these leads, these are the standard leads that you've seen, not the 12 EKG lead, but the standard ones that, you know, they used to put them on your wrist, right, and on your left ankle, and now they basically don't do that so much anymore, but they put them right on your chest, like right here and here, and then maybe one down the abdomen here. But you see them generally like on your two wrist and on your left ankle. And it's, so it's all a reference point. And so it depends which lead you're recording from. Like lead 1 goes positive here to your, from your left arm to your right arm, positive on your left. Lead 2 is positive down at your ankle and negative up on your left arm, I mean right arm, sorry. And then lead 3 this way. So what you can do, and then there's these other leads. So these basically give you an indication of how your heart is lined up this way and how it's functioning electrically this way. And then the other leads that go across your back are basically give you how your heart is working on the side, if you looked on the side of the person, and how it's electrical activity. But what's really neat about these is the person that came up with these, this German guy, is that you can move these three leads together and get them in a center point. Let's see, I had it right here somewhere. That's in this other figure. So this Kansas City, you can always just pop up, mean electrical axis. So here's your leads, you know, left and right. And 1, 2, and 3. What's kind of fun is you just move them together in the center point like this. And so if we did something like this, lead 1. All right, and let's take lead 3. Okay, lead 1 and lead 3. And this is plus, and this is plus, right? And this is negative, and this is negative. And this is really fun. Maybe we should have a question on this or something, because it helps with your lab as well as your class. And it gives you something to do during the exam in case you're bored, maybe. Okay, so let's look at these leads and how this can be helpful. So this would be the zero point. And you notice that each one of these is, if we looked at lead 2 in here, let's just do that. And that one's negative and positive up there too. These are all at 60 degrees angles, right? Because it's just these three crosses. So it's pretty neat. Let's look at an EKG. Whoops, did we do this? Can you see it? Kind of. Is it too blurry? Okay. Yes. Okay. Let's look at like lead 1. If we looked at lead 1, what do we have? We have a P, you know, P wave, a Q, R, S maybe, and a T wave, right? Q, R, S. So let's look at, and if you had a grid box, for example, and you went through here and you looked at the grids, let's say this one is 1, 2, 3, 4 units. Okay, so 4 units. And your Q is 1 unit down, let's say 1 unit, and your S is 1 unit down. So you just take these. No wonder it's blurry. I'll have my glasses on. Okay, you just take these and you subtract them out. So this is 1 and this is 1, so the negatives are add up to be 2, right? And the positives are 4, so it's 4 minus 2 equals 2. So it's a plus 2. Okay, and lead 1. So what you do is, if this was broken up into units, 2, you could take 2, this is plus, right? So 1, 2. And you draw a perpendicular line through there. Okay, it's perpendicular, 90 degree angle. on lead one, since this is lead one. Okay, so you go 2 units over, draw a perpendicular line. Got it?
Can you explain what you're doing down here?
On the QRS? Oh, you're just measuring the amplitudes? So this is 1 unit down, this is like 1 unit down, and this is 1, 2, 3, 4 units up, right? It's kind of fun. Yes? Anybody ever, no one ever did these kind of things? Deprived children. Okay. Kind of fun. All right. And then three, lead three, let's do the same thing. Maybe lead three, let's look at a P, you know, and maybe there's no Q. It depends on the leads. You can have a no Q, it depends on the lead you're recording from, or maybe no S. Let's say there's no Q here. Okay, but you do have a R and maybe a little bit of an S. Let's do that, okay? And if we look at the same things, just to make sure you understand, this is 1 unit. Let's say this is 1, 2, 3 units. So that's 3 units. So what are we going to do here? 3 minus 1, right? The negative, 3 minus 1, right? So then we have 2 again. Okay? Are we all on the same page?
Is it always just
it's the negative minus the positive.
Oh, okay. So it's
like R minus 1.
There
you go.
Uh-huh.
Is it obvious, the amplitudes?
Yeah, of course. You know. I think it'd be fun, don't you? Don't you have enough to do? Pardon? Oh, it's just the units that are on the EKG trace, the little lines that go across it. I'm just doing a unit. You can measure it in millimeters if you wanted to, right? Something. It's just the amplitudes. That's all it is.
Just to make sure. So if that lead 3 had, like, another little Q.
If it had a Q,
it would
say
3 minus 2?
Yeah, or maybe even a half, right? It could be 1.5 minus 3,
okay.
Right? It's just the negative ones minus the positive ones, or the positive. Yeah, positive minus negative. Whatever the units come out to be, is it positive or is it minus? It's just,
it's
a track.
Okay. So, what if the high polarization, what that's bigger than the...
Oh, yeah, then it could be negative. And then you'd have a negative value. And then you would have to put the perpendicular line over here if it was negative. Definitely. Right? But I wouldn't try... That's kind of abnormal, but it could happen. I wouldn't try to trick you on the test. Okay? But so now let's plot this one. So now we have a 2. And which lead is it? Lead 3. What are we going to do? Remember the positive here. We're going to go down. 1, 2, right? And we're going to put a perpendicular line through that. So another perpendicular line. Okay? Now what do we do with that? Now, this shouldn't be confusing. Is this confusing?
Yeah.
Oh, good God. Okay. So all you're doing is making perpendicular lines across the thing. Okay? Perpendicular lines.
How did you know those are positive signs?
What?
The plus?
Yeah, it's plus. It's perpendicular. 1, 2, like 2 units. If I had a grid paper here, then you could do 1, 2 units, right? So now, wait, hold on a second. So now you take this perpendicular line and this perpendicular line that we grew through lead 1 and lead 3, and what do? You go to the origin, just to make sure that we do this right. Maybe we'll get a different color pen or something. Not to confuse you. We'll get a different color pen. And you go to the origin, and you go to where these two lines cross each other. Okay? Well, we'll say why in a minute here. Okay, so now, the origin, 0, to where the two perpendicular lines cross. I think this is going to be fun on an exam. Okay. This will be fun. Okay, so now, what does this mean? We take lead 1 and lead 3. We found the QRS differences in the Q and the S and the R, and we got, these values. And we found it over on a line, a plus line and a plus line. And then we drew 2 perpendicular lines, and where they intersect from the origin of moving the leads 1, 2, and 3 from 0, we've gone to the origin here and draw where they two intersect. So what did we just found? We found the mean electrical axis of your heart. And if you put that up on a person, right, we're looking at the person here, then what does it look like? The mean electrical axis is like this.
Isn't that kind of cool? And that's the way your heart really is. So I tried to draw those realistically, okay? And so your heart is actually about the size of your fist, and it's positioned this way. Now, if you're pregnant, for example, your baby, the fetus, might be pushing up on that heart, and it might be pushing it to the side. And you might be having some cardiac issues or maybe feeling lightheaded. Well, an EKG is really easy to find out where's the mean electrical axis. Is the heart being pushed up and maybe pushing on the aorta and bending it a little bit, or something where you're not getting good maybe flow out? Or is it maybe pushing it the other way and you're kind of pinching the vena cava and you're not getting good filling? But an EKG can quickly tell you how your heart is in a line. Now, when you go to altitude, actually, your heart will start to shift, because what's happening? Low oxygen up there, your heart starts to work harder, and actually your right side of the heart will start to grow, and your right side will start to work up too, plus the low oxygen. You increase your perfusion to your whole lungs because you're kind of low with oxygen, so you're beating faster and you're, you know, trying to increase your oxygenation. And your heart over time will actually have a rightward shift. So you can actually see how the heart is changing with conditions. And in, say, congestive heart failure, or you have COPD, what's happening? Your lungs are not working well, you're building up fluid. So what's happening to the right side of the heart, the ventricle, if there's fluids building up in here, right? And getting into the kind of the capillary beds, and you're trying to perfuse that, so you've got to perfuse more of it. So you've got to pump harder and harder and harder. So what's going to happen to the right side of the heart? It's going to start getting thicker and thicker and thicker. What's going to happen to your mean electrical axis? It's going to shift from the normal over to the right side. See how easy that is to understand what's happening in the heart? That's why the mean electrical axis is so cool. I don't know why I don't know.
Okay, so how do you know to do at least 1 to 3? I mean, yeah, what about two?
You could take any of these three leads, 1 and 2.
Should be the same.
Yeah, because 2 is this way, and negative here and positive here. And if we took the, you know, like some units across here, whatever it might be, and we did a cross like that, right, perpendicular to this lead, well, it's still the origin to where those two lines would cross. It's just the origin to where the two perpendicular lines cross. Yeah, it doesn't matter which lead you're working with. These 1, 2, and 3 leads on the 1, 2, and 3 leads. Okay?
So you never include the
QRS? No, just the QRS complex. Because that's the ventricle, and that's the major part of your heart for the electrical activity. That's a good question. It's the major part of the heart for a muscle. Is that not cool? Don't you think that's cool? I just think it's very cool, right? And so you can tell so much with the heart, and just by mean electrical axis. And it's interesting, like we said, for pregnancy, altitude, disease states of the lungs, for example, and you don't need an echocardiogram. And, you know, you didn't need to do any surgery or anything, just to give a good indication. It's just a, you know, one more piece of information for people, okay? Okay, that took a long time. Okay, so that's kind of fun. I think that's kind of fun to do. So should we do something like that? I think that'd be fun.
Yeah.
I think it'd be great. Maybe. We'll see. If I remember at midnight, maybe somebody will send me an email while I'm writing this thing. Okay. Don't text. Okay, so let's look at some other aspects. Okay, so we went through mean electrical axis. Let's have some discussion on blood pressure and balance. Now, on the lab sections, we've talked about this a little bit already. So blood pressure, balance. Remember, we've covered endocrine. And in the cardiovascular lab sections, we've talked more about the vascular control. But what endocrine responses regulate blood pressure? That we've covered in here. Pardon? A big one that we can just snap off really quick. ADH, antidiuretic hormone, are also called vasopressin, right? So vasopressin, what does it do? Vasopressin?
Increases water reuptake.
Water reuptake, right? So antidiuretic. And it works, we haven't gone into the kidney yet, I know, so the mechanism, we don't have to get down to the mechanism. But basically it promotes aquaporin into a part of the nephron, so you increase water reabsorption. Water reabsorption is going to increase your blood volume, and what's it going to do to your blood pressure?
Increase it,
right? So that increases blood pressure, and where do you monitor blood pressure? Carotid sinuses, like a headache, right? That you have a sinus. So carotid sinuses. Okay, and some other aspects, but the main aspect, carotid sinuses. All right, so now you increase your pressure, and maybe it's increasing too much, so then what happens? Stretching those sensory endings in the carotid sinuses and saying, whoa, we got too much pressure, right? We got to reduce it. So then it speeds back, decreases ADH secretion. Where does ADH come from?
Hypothalamus
through the releasing the posterior pituitary into the bloodstream. Okay, so that's one hormone. So ADH. Any other hormones that help with blood pressure?
AMP.
What does AMP stand for?
Atrial
natriuretic peptide, right? So it comes from your atrium, right? If your atrium overstretched too much, then what does it do? It secretes this hormone. People were like, this is crazy stuff when it came out, that you know, your heart's making a hormone? Come on. But it is. And so it's released, and what is it going to do? It's going to promote water loss. That's the all you have. We don't have to get into the mechanism of it, but we'll do that when we get to renal. But it's going to promote water loss more in the urination, right? And so what's that going to do? Blood pressure? Decrease it. What's that going to do? Feedback on the heart. It's going to decrease the stretching of the atrium. Get the idea? Okay. It's response to stretching of the atrium. So mechanism of action there is stretch of the atrium. Okay. Other hormones you could think of? Pardon?
Isn't aldosterone blood pressure?
Yes. So we did mention a little bit about aldosterone. And aldosterone is a compound. Where does it come from? Adrenal, hypothalamus, something, where? Pituitary, thyroid, whatever. Adrenal something. Adrenal cortex, right. So adrenal cortex. Remember the cortex? What do we call with the cortex? We call mineral corticoids and glucocorticoids. One of the mineral corticoids is aldosterone. We'll get to the mechanism of aldosterone's action in the kidney when we get to the kidney, but what it does is it promotes what? What does it do? Sodium reabsorption. So in the kidneys, if it promotes sodium reabsorption, what's going to follow? Yeah, that's right. So in the kidneys, let's just think you had a big tube there. We'll get into the details later, but a big tube that's going to make urine, if we promoted sodium reabsorption, the water is going to follow that, right? Osmotic gradient. So then you're reabsorbing more water. So if you reabsorb more water, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. And then it can. What's it going to do to the salt concentration in your body? If you increase water too with salt, it's going to dilute it down. But it's going to have an effect on blood pressure, right? So these are kind of more long-term effects, right, for endocrine response. It's more long-term. How about if your blood pressure drops quite quickly? What's going to happen? Oops, blood pressure drops fast. Let's say I cut my leg. Or you had an aortic aneurysm. Or you had an abdominal aneurysm, right? An abdominal aneurysm. You know, your blood vessels. Einstein supposedly died from a leaky abdominal aneurysm, actually. Question, though. Did you have a
question?
Yes, and then potassium. Well, we'll get into that when we get into the renal system a little bit more. But basically,
there's more than
two. But osmolarity is a big factor in your hypothalamus for detecting, right? And how is that? If you had a cell, it's going to have protein and salts in it too, right? And then your extracellular fluid. Well, let's say your extracellular fluid is very dilute. This is the neurons in your hypothalamus. Neurons in your hypothalamus detect what's happening around it. How is this going to change that neuron if it's more dilute salts around it compared to inside the cell? Think of a red blood cell put into distilled water. What's going to happen? Our RBC has proteins and salts inside. Which way is water going to go? Into the osmolarity. So it's going to stretch it, right? It's going to expand it. And what if you had stretch-activated ion channels on there? That then causes the cell to fire. These are neurons, right? So you increase firing rate. Now, what if you're dehydrated in your blood, and so the water's down, what's going to happen to salt concentration? It's going to be higher. So now we've taken it like a red blood cell and put it into seawater. What's going to happen? the water wants to go out, it's going to shrink, and it's going to decrease the stretch-activated ion channels. And that's how your neurons work in your hypothalamus to detect osmolarity, basically. Okay? So it's really coolly, you know, very cool to think about how this detects osmolarity in your body. And so this is what we'll get to when we get to renal and ion balance. But just to kind of make you think about this. So that's more or less osmoregulation, but it relates to blood pressure, right? And so that was good to think about. All right, so now you're riding your bike or something, you fell off, and you know, cut your artery in your leg. What's going to happen to blood pressure? It drops initially, right? Or you had an aortic aneurysm, right? Blood's dropping out. So your blood pressure drops. What detects the blood pressure? Carotid sinuses, right? So the carotid sinuses say, oh, hey, wait, our blood pressure's dropping too much. So what are they going to do? Fire what? Send it to the brain. And then what's going to happen? What? How can you raise your blood pressure quickly? Now, what we've been talking about with endocrine are slower responses, right? So let's think about fast. Some kind of synaptic response, like what type of? Sympathetic, right. Yeah, sympathetic. So now you have a sympathetic response. What's a sympathetic response going to do?
Decrease vagal tone.
Yeah, it's going to, well, that's like the parasympathetic. It'll decrease parasympathetic tone. It's going to increase sympathetic tone, which means what?
Epinephrine,
norepinephrine. But also, and what? Where is that coming from? What's happening here?
No, this is the adrenal.
Well, that too, but also, does the sympathetic have any direct innervation on the heart?
No, it's on the cardiac muscle, right?
Yeah, it's on the cardiac muscle, right? And it's also on the AV node. And it can actually speed up conduction. Now, Wednesday's group, we didn't get to that yet. We will. We did it in the Monday group. It can speed up conduction in the heart, right? Because your AV node is what slows electrical conduction. So the sympathetic innervation on your AV node allows it to speed up. So you're going to get faster electrical conduction. What's that going to do to the heart rate? Increase it. But you also have direct innervation onto your ventricular muscle. And that increases contractility, which is what type of trophic factor we talked about? We got chronotropic, we just talked about, and inotropic. So what's going to happen to the contractility? It's going to be stronger, right? What's going to happen to heart rate? It's going to go up. How do you measure cardiac output? Heart rate times stroke volume. Wednesday, we'll cover that on Wednesday. Heart rate and stroke volume. So now the heart's going to start and increase. But you've got a major artery. So your pressure's going to go up. Your carotid sinuses help to detect, oh yeah, I'm trying to raise pressure. But what have you done? Have you made it worse or better?
Worse
for the bleeding, right? But your carotid sinuses don't care. Your brain's selfish. And it says, I want blood to my brain. I don't care about the rest of your body, right? Brain, number one. No. The brain is really, you know, the main thing, right? Here it's trying to feed the brain. And this is what's detecting it. So now, what did you just do to this aneurysm? It's made it a lot worse, right? There's a lot more blood coming out. So what's going to happen to your blood pressure as you get worse and worse? Heart rate's going to go faster and faster. The heart's going to be beating faster and faster. And then pretty soon there's nothing left to be beating, right? And so you can just bleed out very quickly because of the drastic drop of blood pressure. That's why it doesn't matter if somebody had a bad cut, like in their leg, and they had an arterial cut. You put that tourniquet on, sacrifice the rest of the leg from getting blood, because otherwise the person's going to die, right? So the tourniquet's really important to stop these really severe bleeds. But if it's an aortic aneurysm, it's tough. Look.
I have another question. But so for the carotid sinus, the quick action would be at the aorta, the cardiac muscle.
Directly on the cardiac muscle.
And then you said that the other one was in the nervous.
Well, you have the sympathetic directly innervates the heart, right? But where does the sympathetic come from? Para is cranial sacral. Sympathetic is thoracic lumbar, right on over in the heart, right? But then you have something else with the sympathetic we didn't finish with. Sympathetic also directly stimulates arterioles in your circulatory system, and Wednesday, wait, we'll get to that in class, but then they can cause vasoconstriction of arterial beds, right? Small arterial beds like in your GI tract, right? Or even in the skeletal muscle if you needed to, and can cause then raise blood pressure up, because with these closing off those capillary beds, but then that back pressure would build up in the arteries, right? And they back up. But also, somebody mentioned the sympathetic also works on what gland? For the hormone release? Adrenal?
Medulla.
And then it releases epinephrine, norepinephrine, that then circulates in the blood, and that's going to, you know, work on all these actions too.
So I thought that the heart always had parasympathetic, like the vagal tone, right? So in order to increase like heart rate, it can't just release norepinephrine onto the heart, onto the SA node, and it has to decrease the vagus nerve.
Well, the vagal nerve will try to dampen the heart rate. It's going to probably, in the central aspect, decrease vagal tone, most likely, some of that. But also, you could directly put epinephrine on the heart, and it will increase its beating. So you have this direct action on the heart as well. Okay? Now, we won't get into the little subtle, you know, fighting of that.
I just had a hard time.
No, but it's very good. Oh, I see. So for the class. Right. So, yes, you have vagal tone all the time on your heart. Generally, you have vagal tone that decreases heart rate all the time. So if you cut the nerves that innervate the heart at a resting state, your heart will actually speed up. Okay? Because you have a depression normally on vagal tone on the heart to decrease heart rate. That's normal. Okay. Is that good? If you're doing the right. But when did those do? Or midnight? Or you already handed them in, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's what I thought. Hopefully. Otherwise, you get that big late thing, and then I get in the notice, and then I delete them. Yeah. Okay, so are we good? Okay, so adrenal medulla is also in action here, right? Okay, so that's kind of cool. Okay, and then we listed other cardiovascular ways. That's pretty neat. Oh my gosh. I was worried about getting through this whole thing. Hormones. Let's just, because this is kind of like pulling it together. How do you raise glucose in your body? Glucose is low. What's going to happen?
Break down glycogen.
But what's going to happen right away? Your glucose is dropping. What hormone's being released right away?
Glucagon.
Where do they come from? Glucagon.
Alpha cells.
What tissue?
Pancreas.
Pancreas, right? And so glucagon's released in the blood. What's it going to do?
Break down glycogen.
Where?
In the liver.
In the liver. How does glycogen break down in the liver? Isn't that weird? Right? Weird. Glycogen's going to hit a receptor and work on a cellular cascade that basically turns on enzymes inside that cell to break down glycogen. Do we have to know all those enzymes? No. Right? But the idea is it'll start to break down glycogen. And so, how else, what else might happen? How else could you raise glucose?
Something about growth hormone.
Exactly. Growth hormone. Growth hormone can increase your glucose levels. And how does growth hormone increase glucose levels?
Blood,
right? Glucose in the blood, right? So growth hormone also works on tissues to increase growth, but the idea is you can't grow the cells if you don't get energy in the cells to make proteins and all that stuff, ATP-dependent processes, so you got to get glucose in the cells. But how do you get glucose in the cells? You got to raise it up first in the blood so you can get it to the cells, right? So it's always this kind of continual interaction. So growth hormone can increase. Let's say that bear is going to chase you. Back to the sympathetic response. Are you going to raise your glucose levels? Do you need some glucose to the cells? Yes. So even sympathetic nervous system, you are scared and you need, you know, energy, right? So what's the sympathetic system going to do? It's going to release epinephrine, right? And that epinephrine is going to hit lots of tissues, right? We talked about the heart, for speeding up the heart, but it also can hit a tissue that stores a lot of glycogen, which is the liver. And so it's really quite interesting. You have sympathetic innervation to your liver. Isn't that wild? We didn't talk about the liver. We should talk more about it. But your liver has glycogen, a lot of glycogen stored. There's a lot of vitamin A in there, too. And there's really weird things with the liver. people eat liver. I think it's gross, but anyways. There are people like polar bear liver. People eat that like from polar bears up in Canada and people that live up far north. And sometimes they actually get vitamin A toxicity because there's so much vitamin A in the liver, they actually get toxicity from eating it. It's a real nasty thing, the liver, I think. Because, one, it's a kind of a waste dump. There's a lot of heavy metals that get stored there and things like that, too. But people eat it. It's high nutrition. Actually, we're raising blowflies in the lab, and I hate it because you actually have to feed them beef liver, and then you have to cut it, and it's warm, and it stinks. But the little maggots come out, and we're raising these blowfly maggots that eat dead carcasses, but you feed them on beef liver. And it's interesting why we're doing it, but anyways. Maggots are actually used for wound care therapy, right, in people. They actually put maggots in people's wounds, in animals like horses and things. We got these maggots from a veterinarian in Paris, Kentucky. And they put them in wounds to eat up the dead tissue so you can actually help clean a wound out without having to give high antibiotics, for example. So it is used as therapy in people. It's, you know, probably used across the street here. So anyways, where did we go from this? Oh yeah, the liver has glycogen in it. It's heavy with glycogen. The sympathetic innervation goes to the liver. We don't talk about that much. There are sympathetic, well, that's a really good point. Maybe to really emphasize the liver a little bit. So the liver, and then you think about alcoholism and, you know, liver failure, chronic liver, you know, diseases, not good because it's actually your glycogen stores too, right? And you need that to mobilize glucose pretty quickly too. So your liver is storing glycogen, sympathetic, either from direct sympathetic innervation to your liver or through the adrenal medulla, releasing epinephrine will also increase glycogen breakdown, glycogen lysis, but it also stimulates gluconeogenesis, right? We talked about gluconeogenesis. And if you're exercising, and you really exercise a lot, and you can't get enough oxygen, right? Back to whatever we talked about with the cell metabolism, what happens? Where do you get? You don't have enough oxygen, but you're using up glucose, so you go through glycolysis, but you don't have enough to go through the TCA electron transport. So what's the product here? Lactic acid, right? And lactic acid can go to your liver, and in your liver, what does it do? It actually is converted back to glucose, so it's gluconeogenesis. That glucose dumps back out into your bloodstream, and you can use it for energy. That's kind of cool. So, EKG, yeah, I'll make a note. EKG, EKG, mean electrical axis, liver, glucose. Okay, I'm going to try to remember this. All right, so anyways. This kind of phenomenon is really quite interesting. If anybody's a diabetic, don't tell me. But this is quite interesting. The Somogyi effect is really quite interesting. And if you're a diabetic, you probably pay attention to this because what happens? At night, you normally have a surge a little bit about a growth hormone. So what's growth hormone going to do to your glucose levels? Raise it up. So let's say you're a diabetic and you checked your glucose before you went to bed. Okay, my glucose level's okay, it's at 100 something, you know, it's not 240 or whatever it might be. And you say, okay, I'm okay. And then you check it in the morning, and you found out my glucose level's too high. It's, you know, almost 200 or something. Ah, crazy stuff, right? So what do you think? Maybe there's something, you know, not going on. Or maybe you forgot to check it at night. Let's say you forgot to check it at night, and you just checked it in the morning, and you saw your glucose level's really high. Let's think of this scenario. So you just checked it in the morning, and your glucose level is really high. So what would you think, naturally? You might think, what? I didn't get enough insulin last night, right? I didn't take my insulin shot last night. So what are you going to do the next night?
Take
some more insulin, right? And then you checked it in the morning again, and it's still high, or maybe even higher. Whoa, what's going on? Maybe I should even take more insulin. More is better, right? On everything, more is better, right? No, it's not. So maybe you take even more insulin. And then what's going to happen? And it even might even get worse. So this is this phenomenon right here that we're talking about. And it has the relationship with growth hormone. So normally, and this is why some diabetics eat a little meal before they go to bed, too. And it's to keep their glucose levels up a little bit. Because what's going to happen at night, as you metabolize that glucose, your glucose levels drop. And if you're diabetic, you're not making normal insulin, right? So that's the key thing here. But what's going to happen? Your body says, hey, my glucose level's down. Growth hormones release to raise glucose. So what's going to happen? Glucose levels are going to go up due to growth hormone. And in the morning when you check, your glucose levels might be up because of the growth hormone raising their insulin, your glucose levels. And it didn't have to do directly with your insulin, you know, not getting enough of the insulin last night. It was because your growth hormone went up. But if you inject a lot of insulin at night before you go to bed, what's going to happen to your glucose levels? It's going to drop. Your growth hormone is going to say, hey, you need to get glucose up. Growth hormone release. Glucose goes up. And then it might, you know, in time drop back down. And you might even get a lower, you know, a low level too. It depends on when it peaks and when it doesn't peak. But the idea is that growth hormone rate can increase your glucose levels. And if you're not careful with your diabetes, for example, you can actually get in trouble by not getting the right amount of insulin because of the growth hormone effects.
Is that similar to the IGF-1?
It can. No, that's the somatomedes that we kind of talked about. I mean, but it's related in there, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now because it confused people. Okay, so this is kind of interesting to look up, if you will. I think I pulled one up here. Ooh, where did it go? Oh, darn. The Dawn effect, or the Somogyi effect. And it's this whole idea of monitoring your blood glucose levels in the morning, which could be due to really growth hormone. So you can look this up if you want to and you know get the idea. But the idea, the take home of this, is growth hormone raises insulin, raises glucose levels. Stupid thing. Okay, what's happening? Okay. And so that could cause a problem with your glucose. All right. Insulin is really quite amazing. If you look up insulin and its actions, what it does, and we've talked about some of that way back when, about it being made, and it's, you know, when it's made in the cell, that it's this big precursor protein, and then that it gets cleaved, disulfide bonds, and all that good stuff. And, you know, there's different types of this, like A chain, C chain. But anyways, you get this active form of insulin, then it's released in the body. What's the problem with diabetics? What's diabetic 1, diabetic 2 refer to? Diabetes? Right. Yes. So diabetic 1, diabetes 1, or type 1, if you will, you're usually not making insulin. And it usually comes about with an autoimmune disease, right? That you're, what cell does insulin come from?
Beta cells.
So these beta cells are not releasing insulin, right? You can't make the insulin. So this is why you take injections of insulin. All right, so that's really quite neat. It was really neat when Banning and Best got the Nobel Prize with this because they could actually find out that bacteria could make, you can have bacteria to make insulin. That was really cool. That was up in Toronto, Canada, actually. And so that's kind of neat that they have a whole institute in Toronto, Canada called the Banting Best Institute, and they study diabetes, and they actually kind of lead the world in a lot of care. But anyways, so beta cells, insulin's released, right? And then that then works on the cells to increase glucose uptake, right? And it's really neat how it does that. We don't have time to get to everything, but we didn't cover it in some other class in cell biology. You cover this as a cellular mechanism? No, nothing practical in that class. Okay, so it can work on the insulin receptor and actually trigger inside the cell to put glucose transporters into the membrane. That is so cool, right? Promote glucose transporters into the membrane, and then that allows glucose to go inside the cell. And that's how insulin works. And so it's really quite interesting. All right, diabetes type 2, what does that do to?
Resistance.
Usually resistance of insulin. And that happens to do with sometimes obesity, inactivity, for example. So if somebody's really, you know, morbid obese, for example, then reducing that weight, there's a nice indication that then you can become insulin sensitive again. So that's pretty cool that can happen. So the sensitivity, decreased sensitivity. Sometimes medications can decrease the sensitivity to insulin, so they have to give higher insulin with some medications.
And so there can be lots of causes for this too, and sometimes just age, and you decrease that sensitivity as well. So diabetes type 1, you don't make insulin, usually autoimmune disease. Type 2 is an insensitivity to insulin. So they have to keep jacking it up higher and higher and higher and higher. And it usually is related sometimes with obesity, sometimes medications, and some other factors as well.
Do we need to know about cortisol
effects? That's a great, thank you. We forgot to mention that. Cortisol also can increase glucose levels, right? That glucocorticoids, the adrenal cortex, glucocorticoids, they can increase glucose levels. They also increase amino acids to be distributed in the body for growth as well. And they can cause muscles to break down, right? But what does all this do? It actually increases energy for cells, right? And other cells, like the nervous system or other things, right? Okay, so we've covered that, covered insulin. Metabolic syndrome is like I talked about, just that you understand that's a kind of a new thing that NIH has actually defined as metabolic syndrome. And a lot of it has to do with obesity, but there's actually five different points that you have to, and I think it's three out of the five you have to have. Let's see. But it's kind of neat. Which I had a, NIH site here is an NIH site. Kind of neat to think about. What is it? It's actually five different aspects. So you have to have three out of the five, I think. Yeah, here it is. Three out of the five with these problems to be on what's called the risk for metabolic syndrome. So metabolic, you know, the whole body. So they just don't call it diabetes. A lot of diabetics fall into this category. Large waistline, high triglyceride levels, low HDLs. HDLs are the good lipids, remember? High blood pressure, that's a key aspect. And high fasting blood sugar levels. So even though you're fasting, you have a high sugar levels. So you meet three out of these five. Am I going to test you on metabolic syndrome? No, I just want you to relate it to the idea that we're talking about with endocrine. We developed some educational components with actually Drosophila in for middle schools and high schools using this as a key focus group. So metabolic syndrome, but a lot of diabetics fall into this level. You can then take that away by exercise somewhat and medications, hopefully. Okay, where else were we? Different types of insulin, just that you've heard about these different types of insulin. I don't want to test you in these different types, but you have now people that are diabetic, because this is a major issue in healthcare, right? And we are in physiology course. Many different insulins, some fast-acting that you've just heard about, like your insulin release from your body, some slow-acting, and it's some kind of an intermediate form, generally. And that's kind of neat, because you don't want it just to have high insulin and then your blood glucose levels to drop all of a sudden, right? You want a slow, progressive insulin that's going to maintain your glucose levels. But maybe after a meal, if your glucose has surged, you need to get it down, right? So maybe some fast-acting insulin to help bring the glucose down, but then you want to maintain it throughout. So you might actually, a lot of diabetics manage with multiple forms of insulin. And so there are groups of these fast-acting, slower-acting, intermediate-acting, and some real long-lasting acting. And this is a whole field in itself. If you're interested in healthcare, and you're not going to maybe med school, or you know, got other things in life that's going on, family and everything else, is that there are people that just manage diabetes, and people that actually give education just to diabetics. And they work in the hospital, they work out in the community, and it's really quite cool, because these can be life-saving for somebody as well. All right, so that's kind of neat to think about. All right, what else did we talk about? Oh, let's go to this other figure. So we kind of finished with that. I put up some things to think about. Oh, these hormones I put up on this web page that, I mean, this is already posted on the page, but we just talked about glucose. So we did talk, and thank you for bringing up cortisol, because I put that back in here to think about making sure that we mentioned these, which I forgot until we got these PowerPoints. Hormones that regulate glucose. Metabolic and developmental hormones. We've talked about insulin and epinephrine and how you can regulate glucose with your sympathetic system, right? Yes? Remember what it does? Okay. And insulin itself. All right. And types of insulin we just talked about. Metabolic syndrome. We've given a little information about that. Some extra aspects that are kind of cool with, what about twins that are born? A boy and a female. And
developing fetus. Some really neat information that people have come up with, that they think that some of that, if you have a boy and a girl, that you can actually masculinize the female somewhat, and that there are some differences, and there's some indications that that can change how they development and long-term and even behavioral differences later on. But it's good with two females together because you don't have that interaction so much. So that's kind of cool. Fertility hormones, really quite cool. What kind of fertility hormones do you think that people get to try to increase fertility? You know, when you hear about the quadruplets or the six triplets being born, it's usually fertility hormone that's being released. So what type of fertility hormone would increase the number of follicles be ready for?
FSH and LH.
FSH and LH, follicle stimulating hormones, but sometimes they get injections of gonadotropin releasing hormone, right? Because that would stimulate FSH and LH. So the whole idea is to actually balance this really well and stimulate when they need it, but also for in vitro fertilization, if you're going to fertilize the egg that's there, you want the right hormones to be released and maintain it. So they actually depress FSH and LH and then implant, and then they can actually give hormones that will then promote and maintain implantation and the corpus luteum for health. But there's a real whole field to that. I just want you to generally kind of know that. Now, you can go onto Google and do these flashcards. There's tons of them out there. There's lots of things. You just hit flashcards, endocrine test. And you can test yourself, and you can really go through, and it kind of just opens your mind. And some of those hormones are, you know, a little bit wild. We don't, you know, maybe didn't cover those. But the ones that you're familiar with, it just gives you another idea. They could be very useful. And there's just, what did we talk about? Oh, new fun stuff, like with brain injury, they're actually finding erythropoietin actually helps with traumatic brain injury. A new paper that just came out yesterday, I think, on neuroscience. So have fun with the exam. I was going to pass out boards and we were going to do some drawings, but I think we had enough interaction, right?
I had a...
Let me see.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Stop this off so it doesn't record everything.